Alberto. Switch on. Hello. Hello, hello. So, it is working. Okay, very good. Well, it's a huge pleasure to welcome Wolfgang back here. He's, in my view, perhaps the dominant political economist in Europe. He was for a long time, the director of the Max Planck Institute in Köln, where he still is. And that's one of the key, I might almost say, ideological positions to hold in Germany. In my view, he's the leading Marxist political economist around. If he's not the leading one, he's certainly the most exciting and absolutely certainly the most provocative one. Was he always Marxist? Well, no is the answer. Well, he may have different views about it.
No. You're getting there.
So I first heard Wolfgang talk in a lecture which Colin Crouch organised in Oxford in 1985, when I was quite an innocent economist in those days, and he talked on what became a really famous paper called Beneficial Constraints. And this certainly had a huge impact on my thinking and really got me involved in varieties of capitalism. And this marvelous argument said, if employers are confronted with employees who've got employment protection, as was the case in Germany, but not in this country, then they'll respond to that by actually training them more. And this is a very good way of running an export-oriented and highly competitive economy. And this had a big influence on me. So I should thank him very much for that. He then, as it were, this was still at the, how should I say, the apologetic stage of the Strakian career, and he followed this up later by becoming one of Schroeder's closest advisors
for nine months until
there was a bump. Anyway, so Wolfgang, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, David, and it's a great pleasure to be here. It's not so much of a pleasure to talk about a book that you yourself have written. When I write something, I'm happy it's over, and I keep forgetting what. So I had to look at the book before before this. I don't want to read a chapter from it because you can buy the book. It's expensive but good, and read the chapters yourself. What I will do in an academic audience talking about this book is to emphasize a few very fundamental ideas that underlie the construction of the argument, and speak about the conceptual framework where I think it may represent a little progress in our thinking about societies and the development of societies in particular. Now, let me first say something on political economy, and you will recognize the concept that David just mentioned as a continuing concern in this. This book the theoretical program of this book is to further develop a theory of political economy that has four features. One is, it is to be historical institutionalist, but not in the, let's say, contemporary American sense, rather going back to the historical school of economics, which was a continental tradition that unfortunately ended somewhere in the 1940s and 1950s. I include Marx in this story, and the issue that David raised, he's right and he's wrong in the sense that this Marx is sort of new to the picture. He was always sort of underlying it in the assumption that we both share, that the way people make their living is a very important structuring factor for a society, and that this is modified but not done away with by institutions through which people act. So yes, the materialist approach is still there, but it became clearer to me recently how important it is to remember that the physical or the physical reproduction of the human species through labor and in modern societies through capital accumulation is a very central feature of our lives that cannot be, that has to be worked in any theory of social change, and so a sociology that forgets about this fundamental aspect does two things: it forgets about its own tradition, and it forgets about something that is factually extremely important. Historical, in this approach, doesn't just mean that there's time there between one event and the other, or that there is a past. It means that the sequence of events organized into a history has some kind of explicable logic, that there is something going on there, a dynamism that is vested in these systems that are changing. And understanding this logic is not something that can be done away with or ridiculed as philosophy of history. It is the essential question for any macro sociology or macro political economy that we are facing, and recent years have made that very clear. So in this sense, historical institutionalist. At the same time, secondly, not functionalist. Functionalist would mean that there is a mechanism of balance, of equilibrium, that whatever happens will produce a new order, a new system that works, functions in an orderly way. One has to allow for regression, stagnation, catastrophe in these pictures, rather than adopting an 18th century image of human progress where it can only go upwards. And when I will say something on how will capitalism end, then usually people find this a very pessimistic description. I think because it is not functionalist. If it is not functionalist, it has to point to actors, to agency, and to politics, and to the risks of politics. So in that sense, my approach is, at this point, not Durkheimian, but Machiavellian. Machiavelli is the theorist of precarious order, of the politics that are necessary to extract order from a tendentially chaotic world full of conflicts. And he has a bad reputation, but if you read him, you will see that there is an underlying concern. How in a world where there is murder and war and everything all over the place, Italy of his time, how something like peace and order could be restored through politics? It is not his recipes that are interesting, but the question is interesting. And politics means there has to be agency, organization. In his case, some sort of big guy who runs an army. But this is not the important point. There can be accidents, and these accidents can have consequences. And that's the sort of Machiavellian, the deep Machiavellian thing. So then, thirdly, the book is not futuristic. That is, I'm not saying this is going to be like this, and this is the future. It does something else, not even like scenarios. I was impressed when I began to work on these things, before 2008 already, I was impressed by the significance of trends, social or collective, institutional, political trends, rather than events. Yeah, and my effort here is to understand the logic of medium-term trends as they affect a particular kind of society, and develop from this an intuitive, more or less intuitive, understanding of why certain things that are now happen and how they fit into the picture of the long-term development. And the long-term cannot be 2,500 years, but it can be, in my view. I find the time after 1945 in these Western societies extremely interesting. 30 years of relative stability and then a sequence of crises. And I want to understand the logic of this and how different trends sort of work together in producing a dynamism, a historical dynamism of development. Which then gives us a possibility to reason over what might happen next without predicting it, because prediction obviously is impossible. But the history of, I will say something about the history of predictions in the context of political economy later. Even understanding why people make predictions and what that means in the context of a history is important enough. So I will now begin by spelling out some of the main ideas that are behind this book, which consists of a collection of essays. At some stage, I hope to be able to put this into a more coherent scheme. But the underlying point, which I think is a pretty simple construction, which I call a dialectic, a simple dialectic about capitalism. And it involves three statements. First, capitalism cannot exist without being governed, that is, outside the social order. In other words, capitalism pure is impossible. That brings sort of sociology into economics, and brings economics into sociology. And in my view, anything that falls short of this today is behind the time. That is out. Second, in the course of its expansion, capitalism undermines its governability. And more than ever recently under neoliberal globalization. So here is sort of the dialectical element. Capitalism thrives, by undermining its governability, while at the same time it needs government. From this follows, unless the governability of capitalism can be restored, and it is hard to see how this could be the case, that is what I will argue, capitalism will be in a crisis, and the longer the crisis drags along, the more terminal it will become. Yeah? So that's the fundamental, the idea of capitalism needing governance takes up the notion that David mentioned at the outset of beneficial constraints. It needs to be constrained, and that's good for capitalism. If it is not constrained, it undermines itself. It dies. I say in a somewhat strong formula, it dies of an overdose of itself. Yeah? It dies of an overdose of itself. So, second conceptual remark is the historicity of capitalism and its internal contradictions. That will not surprise you after what I've said at the very beginning. But it has sort of a number of implications. Capitalism has a beginning. We can locate this. It is not something that existed all the time, although economists sometimes want to make us believe this. It is something that arises in the 18th century when certain principles of social organization meet with certain technological developments and certain developments in the world of money and the invention of payment systems, credit, and so on. It had a beginning. If it has a beginning, it must have an end. So everything that has a beginning has an end. That's a sort of very simple thing. Nothing is eternal. The question is when and how. And it is interesting that those people who understood capitalism to be a historical phenomenon from the beginning, basically all of them, and I mention Marx, John Stuart Mill, Werner Sombart, Max Weber, Joseph Schumpeter, John Maynard Keynes, all of them expected to see the end of capitalism in their lifetime. All of them. So when I say the thing is going to die and it won't, I'll be in excellent company. Yeah, but why did they do this? And if these intelligent people sort of have they all made mistakes? My point is that what they've seen in their lifetime was a very interesting sort of transformative process where capitalism sort of permanently moves mostly in response to its enemies. So the dynamism, there's a twofold dynamism in the development of capitalist societies. One is it comes from the inside of the capital accumulation process, and the other is attempts of society to take the Polanyian perspective, society as a counter movement against capitalism. So there's always sort of movement and counter-movement. The counter-movement can often be seen as something that ends the thing as it is then. For example, my favorite exhibit one in this respect is Werner Sombart. Sombart in the 1940s sort of divided capitalism in three stages. One is mercantile capitalism, the other is industrial capitalism, the next is late capitalism. Late capitalism happened in, he thought he was living in late capitalism. Why? Because from the trends that he had observed, what he expected to happen, very much like what Schumpeter expected, was an increasing bureaucratization of capitalism in large firms, in labor law, the transformation of the wage relationship into something like a public employment status. Yeah, people get employment protection. They will be paid by skills rather than by what they actually do, like civil servants. So he saw late capitalism as a sort of a transformation of private firms into civil bureaucracies. Yeah, and in many ways, after the war, this was not completely off the mark, because when I remember we were doing work on industrial relations, what we were looking at was the institutionalization of the employment relationship as a protective area inside a capitalist economy, which could exercise some sort of, let's say, labor constraint on the rest of the economy. What you mentioned at the beginning. If you have employment protection, you have to change the way you produce, because otherwise you can't pay for employment protection, and people are not skilled enough unless you train them and retrain them. So this transformation was one that happened in response to the enemies of capitalism. And until the 1960s, the late 1960s, early 1970s, we could have said, well, Zombart thought late capitalism existed already in the 1940s. That wasn't quite right, but we were moving to it. And then comes the neoliberal revolution, which completely turns this upside down. And the interesting question is, how could that happen? In the book, you'll find some speculation on this. What I do here is I will just a little bit talk more on this sort of historical problem. The survival of capitalism in all these stages depended on the action capacity of anti-capitalist forces. These have to have agency, like bureaucracy. Zombart mentions trade unions, he mentions governments, government regulation, changing capitalism. In truth, what this did was that after the disasters of the 1930s, when liberal capitalism had run against the wall, the idea of regulating capitalism, what later became known as state-managed capitalism in the 1950s, 1960s, was a good idea. Both to change the system and to maintain it. Yeah. Now, the problem, however, with thinking about the historicity of capitalism, or our problem, is that when we talk about the end of capitalism, we do not see this dialectic of contestation and transformation. And beyond this, we still stick to what I call the Central Committee Bolshevist fallacy, yeah, which is a society ends if there is some Lenin with his Central Committee who says it's over and now we have socialism or whatever. Yeah. We have to radically disown this view. It is the view of the developmentalism of the 19th century. Spencer would be someone who could always only think in terms of progress. And if an old society ends, a new society comes, but it's better, and it follows immediately, and the better society sort of pushes out the bad society. Yeah, there are in the literature something that those of you who are interested, there's one piece of literature which people aren't aware of. Max Weber was a genius. We all know this. When he was young, he wrote, he gave a lecture, which later became an article, on the end of the Roman Empire. Now, at the time in Germany, everybody had to know about the Roman Empire. It was the time of German historism, as you say. You had to be historically trained in order to be able to be accepted as a member of civilized society. Now, he was, of course, he was very good in Latin, so he knew. He had studied in his doctoral dissertation the agrarian property structure in the late Roman Empire and its slow transformation. The important point is you cannot really use this one-on-one in order to understand the end of capitalism. But what you can learn here is that the society of the Western Roman Empire ended without there being a successor society. It sort of slowly faded away. In his story of the end of the possibility of the state to go hunting for slaves. Yeah, the Roman Empire in the middle of the second century under Hadrian essentially decided that the borders were the borders. And there was nothing to conquer anymore. It was so difficult. If you look at the map, they hardly had any borders and anymore because they had the whole Mediterranean and so on. So they stopped. They stopped the warfare outside the country. Now that meant you could not have slaves anymore. And if you had no slaves anymore, then the whole structure of the economy, which was a money economy, which was an urban economy, sort of completely disintegrated, and in a way which one can call a process of regression. But what happened was that rather than market-oriented production on agricultural, on large agricultural holdings, these agricultural units became early feudal fiefdoms, because the slaves had to be freed and they had to have had to be allowed to have families. And so then, very slowly, over a period of 400 years, you see an emergence of a feudal structure out of a highly developed, highly integrated market economy and money economy. Money almost disappears. The thing slowly turns into a subsistence economy. My point is, I very much urge you to read this article. It's absolutely mind-breaking. And what I think the exciting thing is, it took 400 years for someone, I don't know who it was, to look around and say, ha, we have a new society. It's called feudalism. Yeah, but in between, nobody knew this. And I use this example to improve our thinking about how the end of our society could look like. Maybe as a process of regression into something less differentiated, into more similar local units that become more or less subsistence oriented. In sort of defense against the results of free trade, of markets, and so on. I will speculate on this later a little bit. So, third point. Think about the possibility of an end without a new beginning. About a disorientation among both what Immanuel Wallerstein calls people of Davos and the people of Porto Alegre. Yeah, Wallerstein in an interesting essay, he believes that by the middle of the century there will be two headquarters, Davos and Porto Alegre, and they will do the final battle. I suggest none of the two will have the capacities to act collectively. David mentioned our former work on trade unions and industrial relations, where the capacity for collective action is central in modifying a market economy. And if that capacity fizzles out, a society sort of may enter a process of slow decay, without a capacity to control the direction in which things are going. Slow decay, long-term regression, no progress, but what I call, and I in the book I speculate about this a little bit, taking from Antonio Gramsci, the concept of interregnum. What he calls a period in which the old order is dying, but a new order cannot yet be born. And he has this very interesting sentence following exactly there, where he says, this is a time in which the bizarrest things can happen. Yeah. If you look at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I think that's pretty close to bizarre. Yeah. we're almost already there. So this is for the sort of general idea about how societies move and in what sort of conceptual framework we can try to imagine fundamental social change. It doesn't have to be progress. It can be in the other direction. So then I need to say something on capitalism in order to make this clearer. What is capitalism? Now, I don't want to talk about the various definitions. Here is my definition. First of all, and that might surprise you, but it is completely in line with, let's say, the Communist Manifesto. It is a progressive society, or a modern society. Adam Smith calls it a progressive society, by which he means that it is a society that operates on the principle of permanent improvement, of dynamism, of change to the better. In Europe, until the mid-18th century, people lived in a world that was essentially self-reproducing, where everything was sort of preordained, and there was no... The concept of progress comes up only in the second half of the 18th century. But then, a few years later, you see how it is reflected in the statistics of the economy. Essentially, Angus Madison has produced this interesting curve. This is Egypt here, yeah, the first pharaohs, and this is the gross domestic product per capita, and so it goes. Here we are in the Greeks, in the Greek period. We are in the Roman period. Now we go to the Middle Ages. Now we get into the up. Yeah. This is when capitalism begins. Yeah? This is when capitalism begins. So a progressive society. And what does progress mean? And now we come to the crucial point that affects the social organization of this beast. A progressive society that has coupled its progress to the continuous accumulation of privately owned capital designed for further accumulation. Yeah? In other words, for unending accumulation of capital in private hands. How can that be? Now, the answer is the Smithian answer, which goes back to this guy de Mondeville. In this society, private greed produces public benefits through, in Smith, the invisible hand of the market. Yeah? So it can be in private hands, but because if you let them do this, the result will be the best world for everyone, not just for them.
That's the condition of the thing. And this is the sort of internal, this is where the dynamic begins, so to speak, between capitalism and the market. Later, democracy. Democracy as the intervention into the use of private capital, so that it fulfills the promise of, in the end, benefiting everyone. That's the condition. If that condition is not met, and it is very hard to meet, then you get all these conflicts, contestations that the old theorists of capitalism describe. Instability is part of this order, because it's always about this question: how can I get you to work for the accumulation of my profits? And not just work without motivation, but do very hard work for it, and invest and go to London School of Economics, so that you can work for Apple, so that Apple gets incredibly rich, whereas you can be fired any moment, right? And you still work very hard to get into this position. How can you get people to do this? So there is a permanent balancing act. This is sort of a permanent training act to get people to actually play the game for others. Yeah, there's all sorts of tricks you can apply. Marx, in the 24th chapter of the first volume on primitive accumulation, shows how in the late Middle Ages this is essentially achieved by torture, the workhouse, the criminal punishment for not working, and then sort of slowly progress, quote unquote, among the indigenous workers of capitalism, but on the fringes, lots of slavery, lots of people being forced to actually do this. Marx, in the 25th chapter, describes that without slavery, capitalism could never have existed, because people would not have done this. Yeah, they run away. For example, he makes this test, which is very interesting. The 25th chapter is really like an experiment. Yeah, he looks at the economics of the colonies, and describes a guy, enormously rich, British entrepreneur, English entrepreneur, who takes 2,000 people with him to Perth in Australia to set up a capitalist society firm. After a few days, they were all gone. Where did they go? Land was cheap. It was available practically for nothing, so they wanted to be independent farmers. He had paid their trip, and then they were gone. And Marx has beautiful sort of sarcastic remarks on this guy. Everything he had thought about, only about the capitalist core, the wage relationship, he had completely misunderstood. He had thought that these people were eager to work for him. Yeah. No, of course not. So that's the problem. Secure cooperation of non-owners while preserving and continuing the accumulation of capital. Now, yes, I should go a little faster, and I will, because now the basic building stones are clear. Capitalism as a liberal libertarian utopia on the one hand, and the indispensability of government on the other hand, either in the form of capitalists forcing others to work for them, or the community producing support for the capitalist accumulation process by way of educating people, motivating them, and so on. Also, and the highest form is sort of constraining them to do something, because otherwise their system could not function. I give you examples. One sort of product of government is redistribution. Keynes has shown that without sufficient aggregate demand, capitalism gets in very big trouble, because the capital sort of clumps at the top. It cannot be used because there's no demand. But in order for there to be demand, the market must be corrected, because the market is basically functions according to Matthew 25:29. I'm sure everybody knows the Bible here, where it is said, he who has will be given, and he who has not will be taken away, even the little that he has. Yeah, that you can call this cumulative advantage in markets, but in order for capitalism to have people who buy the stuff, the mechanism of cumulative advantage must be corrected. Otherwise, we have a situation like today: enormous inequality. The capital sort of sitting in the capital in the financial industry, interest rates falling to zero. Yeah, nobody investing. That is sort of blowing up everywhere. We see a world in which this mechanism of redistribution isn't there. It doesn't work. It doesn't work anymore. So redistribution, also in terms of the legitimacy of the system. I give you an example on which is of a recent origin. Silicon Valley, right? All these unbelievably rich people producing machines of which they hope, with very few people incidentally, that they will in a few years, by way of artificial intelligence, displace millions of people in the world who are no longer needed. Lawyers. Who wants a lawyer? If you have a machine that can sort of read all the various judgments and write a complaint and answer a complaint, so you have your machines battling each other. So artificial. So Silicon Valley, they are beginning to think seriously: who is going to do the work? The work being looking into Facebook, seeing an advertisement of a parfum or whatever, and then taking money and buying that parfum, because it's only if this happens that Facebook will get money from the producer of the parfum for advertisement. If nobody can buy this stuff, everybody looks into his iPhone, but they have no money to buy the good things that they are being offered, then the advertisement business runs out. So what do they suggest? The big thing in Silicon Valley now is the guaranteed basic income for everyone. Yeah, so everyone gets, let's say, £1,200 a month from the state, so they can actively participate in the Facebook game. Otherwise, nobody would pay Facebook for publishing advertisements. So the problem is that these very people are masters in moving their fortunes from one country to the other, so it doesn't get taxed. They sort of have the Piketty, they are the core of the Piketty problem. You want to tax high incomes, but you cannot, because they're everywhere. They go, they run away. So who pays for the basic income guarantee? If these people cannot be taxed, maybe they will tax me, but I'll be dead by then. So that's an interesting point, that they are now beginning to demand public redistribution, because they understand that their accumulation dynamic sort of runs into a problem if states are no longer able to redistribute. So, a few other things. Social security. Colin Crouch has wonderfully described this. The problem of capitalism today is to turn insecure workers. They can be fired anytime, and today more than ever in the last 50 years. Turn insecure workers into two things: motivated workers, yeah, and confident consumers. You have to consume even though you don't know whether your income will be over. And, now, if you go to the London School of Economics, it's maybe different, and you have such a good human capital that nobody will ever consider even firing you. However, think about these little machines, the artificial intelligence, event management. They are extremely good at this. Yeah. legal briefs, fantastic. They know all the precedents. Imagine, they go to the database, it takes them a few seconds, and they have all the relevant judgments in hand. Building bridges, these things can build bridges like whatnot. And so, in spite of this, you have to be confident consumers, because otherwise the thing can't work. More conventional things, collective infrastructure, physical infrastructure, in spite of the tax flight. Reliable money is a very important question. Right now, the central banks are producing money on end. No way, no limit. The typical constraint that you need on money production. Money is in Polanyi's terms a fictitious commodity because it cannot be produced according to demand. Imagine money was produced according to demand. We would produce money without end. So now we're beginning to approach a situation where money is produced like this. Yeah. The demand being to maintain the financial system in good health. Yeah. All these sort of strange... I give you one example of the German debate. Germany is not more... Other countries are more hit by secular stagnation, as they call it. But it's still there. And now the German economists begin to think about using money to re-stimulate the economy. Now, zero interest rate doesn't work. The inflation rates don't go up. Doesn't work either. What do we do? They come back to Milton Friedman about the helicopter money. Helicopter money is money that you drop from a helicopter, so people pick it up, and then they go and buy something. Economists now seriously debate whether helicopter money can work. It's such a bizarre idea anyway, but the problem is that since they are all in debt up to their ears, they may use the helicopter money to pay off their debt, and then nothing happens. Yeah. And now they are even thinking about how to make sure that everybody gets a bank account. So if you distribute 3,000 euros per person, everybody has to have a bank account. Now, of course, the obvious problem is I could have 5 bank accounts, and then I would have 5 times the helicopter money. But the reason why I mentioned this is that this is actually being discussed. Yeah, it's actually being discussed by serious people. And because they don't know anymore. It is the attempt of the capitalist accumulation process to rely on a particular modification of the monetary system that would re-stimulate capital accumulation at the risk of destroying confidence in money. And finally, a stable periphery. You need capitalism is an expanding system, which means that it has a periphery. The periphery must be stabilized because these are people or countries that need to be educated in the proper behavior of workers and consumers. This involves that you apply some military power to them, because otherwise they won't learn. Now, capitalism always develops together with. I'll stop in 5 minutes, but let me finish this particular idea. Capitalism in its history always developed together with a host nation. That combines financial and military and cultural power. Yeah? We are talking here about Florence,
Then we're talking about Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Then we're talking about London and England. And now we're talking about the United States. This central power has to have the capacity to control, to produce stable money and stable violence. That is to prevent wars and prepare the fringes for the growth of the capitalist system. The United States can no longer do this, both for internal and for external reasons, and nobody else is there to take it, to take their role. I will stop here because the rest we can deal with in the discussion. I spoke a little bit too long, but I thought that I wanted to lay out the conceptual framework and enrich it with a few examples that, that should make it plausible that we want to think about a future of, or a near future of interregnum, lots of disorder, lots of uncertainty, lots of unpleasant events. Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, recently published a book which is called The End of Alchemy, which is all about uncertainty, the great uncertainty, and his analysis of what is coming is not so different from the analysis of someone like myself. I start at a very different angle, but he looks at the internal life of the money system, and he says, all bets are off. Thank you.
So, thank you very, very, very much. We've got about half an hour left for questions. If you want to ask a question, can you say who you are and what you're studying or what or whatever? Let me to get to get you going. Let me ask the first question, which is. If one thinks about the collapse of the Roman Empire, and one looks around this country at the moment, one is inevitably left thinking that all sorts of stable institutions, which we thought we could rely on, are crumbling. Now, perhaps that's silly, but would you like to start off by talking about what you, how you interpret Brexit?
I know it's an English obsession, but if you put it in the proper context, you see that it is not unique. What I'm talking about, or what we should be talking about here, is a general crisis of the international state system and of the governability of capitalism by states. The point here is the fundamental change from markets located in states to states located in markets, which comes with the competition state. It comes with the declining taxability in Europe. One solution to this problem that was envisaged was to form a larger state. That has all sorts of dysfunctions internally, of legitimacy, representativeness, how you forge a common policy out of different traditions, diversity, variety of capitalism. At the same time in Europe, you see the opposite movement from the national state level to the small state, to the small regional state. Take Denmark, a very happy country, outside of the monetary union, sort of able to specialize on a particular niche in the global economy, which Britain as a whole could never do, although it tries to specialize on finance, but then it sort of divides itself into two nations, London and the rest of the country, as you see in the Brexit vote. the Scots think that their future is sort of at the lower level, at the smaller unit. At the same time, in an act of, I think, complete confusion, they want to adopt the euro, which would, they would gain their sovereignty. At the same time, they would give it up to Mr. Juncker. It was a strange idea. Yeah, and so you see how there is experimentation going on with what is the right scale of government. And the fact that the British, now you can tell a British story, which I won't, because you know the story much better. It involves Margaret Thatcher and her fundamental contribution to turning the European Union into what I call a liberalization machine, rather than a social welfare state. If it ever might have become one, that would have been in the 1980s, then the path was clear. Yeah? So Thatcher sort of destroys the state building operation for a market building operation. Then the British trade unions think, for some strange reason, that Delors will deliver a social dimension in addition to the market that Margaret Thatcher delivered. Yeah, and I remember in 1988, the Bournemouth TUC. He appeared, and the British trade unionists gave a rousing rendition of Frère Jacques in French. They were singing a French song, British trade unionists, for him. Because they were so impressed with him. Yeah. Then the social dimension disappeared. And now, of course, as a worker in Britain, all you see from the European Union is that it brings in addition to Commonwealth immigration and in addition to refugees, however many there are, lots of immigration from Eastern Europe, many of them very, very hardworking, willing to do all the jobs that one might have hoped as a British worker one wouldn't have to do anymore. And then now you see in this thing a policy parameter for the British government to change the composition of its workforce in a way to make it more fitting for the British type of capitalist accumulation. And then all sorts of other things come on top of it, but that to me is sort of a very fundamental part of the story. It has to do with the fundamental problem of states related in markets and losing their capacity to control the economy, the accumulation process, and these things, becoming competition states, where 2004, Tony Blair, for some reason, when the Eastern countries joined European Union, did not ask for what he could have asked. This is 7 years of intermission in terms of immigration. He wanted them right now. Maybe because he thought, then they will always be with me if I become the great leader of the European Union. Yeah? I don't know. But this resulted in 750,000 people getting into Britain in a very short time. Yeah. What do you expect as a result?
Yes. The gentleman with white right here. No. Oh. Gentleman with white hair first.
Sorry.
And who's the...
Yeah, my name is Larsen. I come from Copenhagen Business School, and I found your presentation very interesting. But the chairman, he was so nice to present you as a Marxist in the beginning of your lecture, so I took that as a standard for evaluating your presentation. And I have a problem with your presentation from that standard. If you have posed your own as a Weberian, would be wonderful. This morning I visited two rooms at the British Museum, one about the money development, historical development of money, and the other the development of the measurement of time. And I think I'm and now tonight you have given an exposé of the development of capitalism, but I think what I miss in all the three rooms, to call your presentation also a room, is a presentation of the principle in the room, of the rooms. I miss a presentation of the principle, the dynamic principle in the three rooms, and my own hypothesis would be that it's the same principle, namely the abstraction. Marx, he did not, he gives the exposé of the die Fahr form, the form of the commodity. Yeah. And I think that could it be an idea to integrate that in your analysis to present that capitalism cannot be reduced to historical phenomena, to turn your thesis around? This is a question.
Yeah. It is a question, and I even think that it can be answered to your satisfaction. Yes, I'm rather than using the Hegelian framework of the first three chapters of Capital, I've come to the conclusion that for a sociologist at least, and for an empirical macro sociology, a better approach is through Karl Polanyi and his process, his concept of the commodification of land, labor, and money. And that covers a lot of what Marx develops on the Warenform in the first three chapters. What it adds to it, in my view, is this. I used Machiavelli. I could also have said Polanyi, because Polanyi is in an interesting way undecided as to which are the most important forces in history, the forces of commodification or the social counter-movement. In 1944, he thought, together with Schumpeter and certainly Zombart, that the great transformation had already happened. Yes, and that transformation was one in which liberal capitalism turned into forever state organized or by society organized, contained, controlled capitalism. The last chapter of the Great Transformation describes this picture: freedom in a such and such society, where this society is a well-ordered society. Yeah. So this battle between two forces is something that appeals more to me than the Hegelian logic from A to B and so on, like an independent mechanism. I allow for more interruptions in the process. I also allow for periods in which things go badly wrong. Whereas in the Marxian view, things cannot really go wrong. Because there may be struggles and there may be dead bodies all over the place, but ultimately the thing has to move up to a higher stage. If I may add that, because this is such an interesting point that also comes up in the book, the reason why capitalism could sort of develop the way it did was it had an opposition, the labor movement, which had two different objectives. One is to preserve of capitalism that which was modern, and at the same time extract from or throw out of capitalism what kept society back. Yeah, and I want to allow for the possibility that the former does not work and the latter doesn't work either.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I am Natalia. I am from Argentina. I'm doing a PhD on international labor law. And I wanted to ask you If you think that the implosion of capitalism or slow process, as you put it, could come also because of this insecurity and flexibility of the working conditions of workers, in particular, and this delirium of Silicon Valley about the machine replacing and technology replacing human beings at work, because this was also a myth in the Industrial Revolution, and but the basis of capital accumulation is surplus value, and to have surplus value is not just a consumer in Facebook, but you need people just working. So do you think this implosion come from that also, and from this logic of thinking people are just consumers? And also a second point, because from a Marxist point of view also, and because there are a lot of young people here, when you say that the capitalism will end in an uncertain way, it's not contradicts also your point about the history and your vision about the, to understand history, we need to understand not events but trends. So if you could develop a little bit that, because okay, we can see trends and we could see also how to move to a better thing. No, in the sense, I want to be positive, positive.
You should be positive.
About labor and your initial question. See, I get older, so my short-term memory is not good enough for two questions. I only can answer one. My long-term memory is excellent, I must say, but my short-term memory is. So the first question. Yeah, it is the Silicon Valley thing does not reduce itself to the basic income guarantee, which I mentioned. For example, you take a place like Uber. I think they have 1,400 people employed in regular employment, whereas hundreds of thousands are working for them. Yeah, as so car owners, who the value of Uber in the stock exchange is several billions, $2 or $3 billion, yeah, with this very tiny workforce. And so there you're beginning to see that the accumulation process is beginning to sort of throw out labor, yeah? Divorce itself from the labor relationship. That's an interesting question, whether this actually can happen. You need a lot of very inventive financial manipulation. Another example, I think, is Facebook, which is even more worth in the stock exchange. But there, the work that people actually do for Facebook, the valuable work, is not paid at all. It is you with your data, with your information. This is what they sell. They don't sell something that someone produces in wherever they are located. And in that sense, I think we have to rethink the importance of labor for this system. Final point on this, what was his name? Keep forgetting his name. American economist who in this nice book on the end of capitalism, which appeared 2 years ago, writes an article on the middle class and the threat of artificial intelligence to the middle class. Now, the point that he makes is the same that you make, namely that we had this package of technology making a lot of people redundant. It did not happen. He says why? Because the children of these people are you. Your generation sort of moves up into the middle class and acquires all these sort of middle class skills that have not yet been made redundant by technological development. Now, he says, comes the next step in this process, which is where the middle class is being attacked by technological development. And they have nothing where they can go. The ceiling, there's a ceiling there. And for a multi-billion firm like Apple, only very few people can work. The rest are somewhere out there.
thank you, Wolfgang. You've restored my faith in the human intellect, which was wobbly a bit most recently. You haven't mentioned climate change and the environmental crisis, but that's an obvious case where the accumulation machine quickly runs into insoluble problems. And I was struck by your sort of prognosis of a slowly decomposing, decentralized, less dynamic, more subsistence economy, which is precisely what many post-growth theorists argue. Do you think this is a route to this different future?
In my view, if this isn't managed, and it happens the way it may be about to happen, then this comes with enormous differences in wealth and power. Yeah, the new fiefdoms, the neo-feudal structures, will be governed by the board of Apple or Microsoft or whoever, and they will still exist. The one process of we had this discussion in industrial sociology for decades. The term was refeudalization. Firms becoming independent entities that suck in, so to speak, social structures that used to be public structures and then become privatized. If I speculate around a little bit, then I would think that what we observe in the world of Facebook is interesting in the following way. It's interesting in many ways, but also in the following way. Historically, social structures are built between people that know each other, that see each other, that begin to organize a trade union, so to speak, in the public sphere. Now, if you organize a relationship through Facebook, you do this through the private property of a big company that is all over the world. In other words, this company internalizes social structures and privatizes them in the sense that it makes them open to targeted advertisement and to selling the individual properties and the relational properties of these people to advertisement firms and so on. That I would call a process of feudalization. Could be, yeah, the regression from the public into the private sphere. I give you another example. I recently read a book from a French social geographer who describes the following process. In the French society, with the opening of the society for immigration, the people that are negatively affected by this are lower class whites or indigenous people. They begin to develop quasi-tribal structures that they withdraw from the rest of the world, and they live in the same, they meanwhile live in ghettos in the same way in which the immigrants live in ghettos. This too is a sort of withdrawal from the public sphere. They become sort of tribalized. How does this express itself? One thing is they all vote for the Front National. A parallel example is countries like Greece, Spain, and Italy, where young people who are in their mid-20s up to their mid-30s continue to live in the families of their parents. They have no jobs. 50% of the young people are out of a job. They have no income. They cannot marry. They live off the pension of their parents and in the sort of inherited apartments that their parents still have. So that's another process of regression, I would think, where the state as a protective force is replaced by tribal family relations that withdraw from the rest of society. That's an explanation why you cannot reform the pension system of Italy, because if you try to do this, you take the money away from these new defensive alliances grouped around families and ethnicity.
Good. Hi. Thanks. I work in the cumulative aggregation industry. I wanted to ask where you think the borders of capitalism are, because... Yeah, or whether there aren't any, because that's one big difference with the sort of Roman Empire, right, is that now we have this global thing and maybe there's no borders, or do you think that actually the regression will mean that these larger powers, which are maybe a little bit outside of the definition of capitalism, move in to change it and take over?
Yeah. Conceptually, you can get to this by remembering Rosa Luxemburg, who at the beginning of the 20th century wrote a book on imperialism. There, the central concept is that of land grabbing. The interesting thing about this concept is that she has an extensive as well as intensive definition of land grabbing. Capitalism can expand in space, but it also can expand inside societies. An interesting case, for example, is the number of hours families sell to the labor market over, let's say, in a weekend, in a week or in a month. This has enormously increased. Many of what used to be household activities are now market-mediated activities. Yes? So there you have a sort of intensive land grabbing. You also can have extensive land grabbing in the present world. If you look at the large number of failed states on the periphery of the American quasi-empire, then that would, for me, be places that in a functioning international order would be prepared by the hegemon for investment, for extraction, for consumption, and so on. Now they become ungovernable. And so if you look at the broad, at the growing part of the world that is ungovernable, these are parts that cannot be used anymore for extensive accumulation.
Good evening and thank you for being here. My name is Peter Trevisan and I'm a postgraduate student at the European Institute. I also appreciate your account of the end of capitalism as a slow decay without sudden transition to a new system. But before this decay takes place, I wanted to ask you if you think that history can repeat itself in the sense of, do you see any possibility of a return to an international Bretton Woods-like system with greater capital controls and Keynesian demand management on domestic levels?
Yeah, I'm not. I said I'm not in the futuristic or prediction business. What I, however, can say is something that you can also say. You can sort of specify the conditions under which we learn from history such a thing would be possible. Historically, capitalism always needed one center. And one functioning center that combined monetary and coercive power. The question is whether we can see this today. There, my point would be all you can hope for would be a co-directorate between China and the United States. Can you imagine this? I hardly can. Especially since the United States, if you look at the present election and at the changing social structure of the United States, is in such terrifically bad shape. Yeah. What I would rather see is the possibility that the Chinese will sell their T-bonds. They will no longer finance the United States, which they have done for a long time, that the United States will no longer open their market to them, which will all be sort of regressive and very, very difficult, dangerous things. So my answer would be, if you go by historical experience, it's very hard to see. Can we preclude that some sort of co-directorate will be found? Not completely. I would not rule it out, but I don't see it.
Hello, my name is Anaï. I'm a PhD student at the government department here at LSE, and I wanted to ask you something with regards to your conception of the state. So, in Buying Time, your previous book, you talked about the transition from the debt state to the consolidation state. And it seemed to me there that you had a conception of the state which pretty much was very much in line with the Marxist conception of the state as kind of a puppet of the, well, what you call the second constituency. Yet, here it sounded a bit different. So here it sounded like you wanted to actually leave more room for accident, as you call it. And my question, I guess, is something on the lines of what role do you think does the state have, and how can the state act in order to either continue offering the political conditions of possibility that allow for continuous accumulation, or to actually give us some hope for a better future, basically.
David, you're pointing. No, but I'll answer the question, right?
Yeah, I wasn't. Yes,
I saw your arm going.
I was implicitly pointing at you.
Oh, okay, good, good. I think I may say that you may have misread Buying Time. The book spells out. I abstain from essentialistic discussions of what the state is. I look at the state in the transition from state-centered to neoliberal capitalism. In this period, you see that governments, to make it a little less essentialistic, that governments have to very carefully move between two different equilibrium points, as I call it. One is a political equilibrium point, the other is an economic one, and the two cannot be brought together, less and less. So there's a dilemma. And governments move from one side to the other and hope that the damage they do on the first side by moving to the second side will materialize only later, so that they can take care of it then. And I think that's an adequate description of what the state has, what states have been doing in this period. They invent ever new fixes on both sides. Yeah, but now it becomes more and more difficult. Because in the process they've destroyed all the productive institutions like trade unions, labor market regulation on the one hand, and on the other hand they've become unable, in spite of all monetary activities, to revive the accumulation process. Yes. So here my answer to this is, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But what I see is, if I would look to the future, I would think in the next few years, we would still have what you can loosely call a dictatorship of the central banks, and complete attentism on the part of fiscal policy, which doesn't know what to do, in a world in which governance structures are basically crumbling.
Hi,
I'll
keep it as short as possible.
And there are three other questioners.
Can we take you to start with, and then.
Yeah, you go
sure.
On.
My question concerns patents. And in the last 30 years, there's been an exponential increase in patents. And I think China now is the biggest producer of patents. And it kind of concerns the free market, and to the extent that huge companies engage in, like, hoovering patents, and how this will kind of affect the free market and kind of help the end of capitalism.
My question is about how information technology is allowing capital accumulation to involve labour less and less and less. What you think that is leading to, and if labour is less involved and becomes less important to those controlling capital, whether the relationship of the state becomes less relevant and the institutions therefore don't function, and that's how we reach our end times for capitalism.
Hi, my question is that, do you believe that there will be labor troubles in the future due to advancements in technology? And if yes, what are some of the solutions from a Marxist point of view?
And then finally,
Hi, sorry, and I would have liked you to talk more about the implications of basic universal income as a mean of redistribution in the short and maybe long term. Thanks.
Yeah. I begin with the last question. The basic income thing was always a bit of a mystery to me, and politically a mystery, but also that very different people with very different intentions have been in favor of this. So Ralph Dahndorf, the liberal, was a big advocate of the basic income. Ronald Dorr was one, but then also the people on the left, people on the right, now Silicon Valley. I think it creates the illusion of an easy fix to a number of problems, like the problems of the welfare state, the problem of aggregate demand, the problem of political unrest, and so on. And I'm always sort of suspicious of solutions that seem to work for everything, yeah, or are offered as an answer to so many different problems. The political feasibility, my experience in my little experience in the way political governments work, I think it's completely out of the question. At least not in the next 20-30 years. I don't know beyond this. This is all foggy, but can you imagine in the European Union, with Britain in or Britain out, doesn't matter, one country, let's say Denmark, beginning with basic income guarantee, and then at the risk that people from Spain or whatever would go to Denmark, and as Europeans would ask to be covered by the Danish basic income guarantee. The Danes are sensitive about this, as we know, yeah, and lots of other people would be sensitive. So in fact, you can say all the money that went to banks could have been broken up and given to people. This is the helicopter money thing. And what sort of consequences this has, I really can't tell.
Probably quite quick.
Yeah, labor troubles in the future. I think that small local labor conflicts will be more frequent than they used to be in the last 10. But that's part of the dispersal of political agency. When David and I studied labor relations, we thought about strikes and trade unions as the second pillar next to electoral democracy. So democracies had two pillars, elections and strikes, so to speak. Strikes being trade unions. So in that role, I don't see unions anymore. The patents, yeah. David knows more about patents than lots more about patents than I do. I understand that they can be used to obstruct technical development on the part of your competitors. You simply buy them and then you sit on them. You can also strategically buy or sell them. It's a world that I have to admit I don't completely understand.
Okay. Okay, well, Wolfgang, thank you so, so much. I should say... That's terrific. Wolfgang, I think, is as a true capitalist, is going to sell his book.
Not on me, the publisher.
The publisher. Sorry, he's just like. So, how did the publisher get you to do this? That's really the question.
Yeah, that is a question. that's a question. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Good. Wolfgang, that was so. You heard the applause.
Good, seriously.